From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, listeners to this show. We're grateful for every one of you. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Hindus celebrate Krishna Jayanta, the birth of Krishna, on Saturday the 5th of September, and Tuesday marks the Christian celebration of the Nativity of Mary. It's Labor Day weekend. Good grief, where did summer go? Over the years, this public holiday has turned into one last chance for some summer fun, disconnected from the real meaning of the occasion. In truth, we have the labor movement to thank for the very idea of a weekend for workers, and the fact that kids across the nation are heading back to school and not back to factories. In an age when millionaire CEOs are lauded as the job creators and workers are seen as dispensable, it's vitally important to remember that a cornerstone of our economy and our culture is a middle class of workers treated fairly and ethically. It's encouraging that the president is pushing for a long-needed increase to the minimum wage, and that candidates as diverse as Bernie Sanders and Rick Santorum are including the needs of working Americans in their campaigns for the White House. We need to not just hope that that continues, we need to demand that it continues. As we get ready to celebrate the 10th anniversary of State of Belief this coming January, we're revisiting a couple of Labor Day interviews from years gone by to see how the conversation has or has not changed around this important issue. Now, here's what else is coming up on this week's show.
They did an MRI and found that there were four spots of melanoma on my brain.
When President Jimmy Carter recently shared the sad news of his cancer diagnosis, it was striking how calm and at peace he seemed to be. A lot of us instinctively attribute that, at least in part, to his religious faith. As President Carter did refer to his religion occasionally, but what role did religion play in his administration, and how can it help us understand the grace with which the 90-year-old former president is facing his latest challenge? On this week's show, I'll ask Gordon Tucker, who was a White House fellow in 1979. That's right. We'll also have another edition of the Intersection Awards, where we take a look at recent near misses and collisions at the intersection of religion, government, and politics. But first,
in less than a month now, Pope Francis will arrive in the U.S., first to our nation's capital, meeting President Obama at the White House, and doing something no pope has done before, giving an address to a joint meeting of the United States Congress.
At the end of this month, Pope Francis will travel to Philadelphia for the World Meeting of Families. The trip will include stops in New York City and Washington, D.C., where the leader of the Roman Catholic Church will address a joint meeting of the United States Congress. Next week, the rather notorious organization Act for America will host a conference in which 14 members of the House of Representatives are expected to participate. Besides featuring the largest bald eagle I've ever seen on a website, the organization also focuses on blaming Islam for most all of the ills of the world today. Bad things happen when either religion or politics are used in the service of the other. To discuss whether we're crossing that line, I'm joined by Rabbi Jack Moline, Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance. Jack, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
It's just like coming home, Welton. Thank you.
Let's start with the ACT conference. You issued a strongly worded statement addressing political leaders taking part in this. Tell the listeners a little bit about this conference and then why you offered such a serious statement regarding it.
So ACT for America is one of those organizations that has taken as its mission the denigration of Islam and the people who practice it. It really is a very troubling organization, headed by someone who's not a Muslim. She's an Arab, Brigitte Gabriel, and who claims to have been a victim of extremist violence. And I have no reason to doubt her particular story, but she's extrapolated that to a condemnation of Islam and all those who adhere to it based on her particular circumstances. She founded this organization in order to, quote-unquote, alert America to the danger that faces them from people who are practicing Muslims, and has put together this conference that features a variety of people who are legitimately describable as Islamophobes, and has invited and received confirmation from members of Congress, at this point 14 in all, who will be there and participate in this conference. It's simply shocking and inexcusable.
Well, you know, Jack, bias against people who are perceived to be Muslim continues to be a serious problem in this country. So you set down in the middle of that, this ACT conference. Do you think political leaders taking part in a blame Islam event like this makes it all worse?
Well, of course it makes it worse, because when you have people who are elected officials, they become validators of any position that they take, even if it's not in the general society, among those who are so inclined. Instead of speaking out against stereotypes and biases, they wind up reinforcing them. And the only reason, Welton, that I can think they're doing this is for the votes, that they think by appealing to a base of people who include prejudice as part of their values, they will find themselves reelected to the United States Congress. And that's very troubling to me. It's troubling from an incumbent. It would be troubling from a candidate. It would be troubling even from someone who is not standing for office.
So is there a call to action for Interfaith Alliance members and our listeners to help discourage their elected officials from endorsing a conference like this with their presence?
Well, first and foremost, the call to action is for our listeners to educate themselves. They should know what ACT for America is. There's a website. They can see that Brigitte Gabriel has placed at the very top of that website a quotation from Winston Churchill, whose life ended 35 years before the events that she claimed inspired her even began, in which he calls for an opposition to terror. He was, of course, speaking of the bombing of London, not of the World Trade Center. And they need to educate themselves as to what ACT for America is all about. And then they need to take that education and share it with their elected officials and their candidates for office, so that there's no excuse for somebody saying, well, he didn't know, he wasn't aware. And then they have to tell their friends, because the only way that we're going to reduce this scourge of prejudice in our country is if people of conscience speak out.
Jack, I want to shift from politicians and religion to religion and politicians, if I may. Pope Francis is addressing a joint session of Congress later this month. I know that both of us have major concerns about this. I'd like for you to detail your concerns about it.
Yeah, actually, the two issues are very much interrelated. Although I want to make very clear that I don't make any equivalency between the goodwill of Pope Francis and the ill will of ACT for America. What's at stake here is we have a religious leader who is addressing a legislative body that is constituted under the documents of founding the United States of America. My concern is that out of respect for this great man and his insight into the human condition, the audience is going to forget that they are listening not as members of a church or people seated in pews, but as representatives of the United States of America and the values that it stands for. Whatever Pope Francis says should be understood as his representation of what the Roman Catholic Church stands for, which I honor and respect. But in the end, the decisions that need to be made in the chamber in which he's speaking have to be based entirely on the Constitution, not on the suggestions of anybody, domestic or foreign, who comes to deliver a message that is not 100% consonant with the Constitution of the United States.
If you were the Pope's warm-up act, what would you say to our legislators as they prepare to hear Pope Francis?
If I were the Pope's warm-up act, well, first of all, I'd probably tell a story about a rabbi and a priest walking into a bar. But then I would say to them, you're about to hear from a great man with tremendous spiritual insight, and I hope that the words that he speaks touch your very soul. But when it comes to making decisions about the future of this country, please remember that we are not all Roman Catholics. We're not even all members of the Abrahamic traditions. We're not even all people of faith. But we're all Americans, and we are all depending on you to support and defend the Constitution, which is what you promised to do when you took office.
I'd love to hear that right before that speech. You know, we seem to be bumbling around these issues somewhat, with people taking too many things personally. And this goes back to Benjamin Netanyahu's address to Congress a few months ago as well. What guidance can Interfaith Alliance offer both voters and leaders on better dealing with these kinds of issues? Because it's really not ideological at all. The same rules should apply to everyone.
So I think here's where Interfaith Alliance occupies a niche in this conversation that is not being well filled by anybody else. We really have a unique message. There are people who believe so absolutely in the separation of church and state that they are completely opposed to the presence of any voice of a faith community in public. We have organizations with whom we find ourselves in coalition who are regularly critical of the entire endeavor of a faith community, of religious belief. They defend that separation well, but with a bias against the faith component. Mm-hmm. Then there are people who believe that there should be no separation between their particular religious beliefs and the policies of the United States. And they are threatened and frightened by the notion that they might have to give up what they've presumed to be the status quo. Interfaith Alliance occupies the ground that I think is what Jefferson laid out in the Bill of Rights and what the United States government has upheld beautifully over the course of these hundreds of years of the United States existence. And that is that faith is an intensely personal and private matter. And that while the values that we believe in need to be brought to the public sphere, the thing that protects us from having those beliefs compromised is the Constitution that guarantees the same rights and privileges to every member of this country. And we need to take the responsibility to defend those rights and privileges, not just to claim them for ourselves. That's the message of Interfaith Alliance.
I do want to ask what else Interfaith Alliance is working on this fall.
I want to emphasize that we have other things that are still continuing, Welton. I know our focus right now is on the Pope's visit and some of the issues that will surround his presentation. But we are still focused on marriage equality, which is now fortunately the law of the land, but is not quite the practice of the land in every corner we look. So our Everyone Only campaign is still alive and well, and we hope that particularly in those states that have or are considering Religious Freedom Restoration Act processes, that people will take those to their local merchants and ask them to put them in their windows. And that's everyone-only.org. You can find that information there. And we are, of course, continuing our advocacy for religious freedom. We are looking at the Equality Act, which has just been introduced and will begin deliberations this fall. And we are looking at the federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act and how it can be strengthened to ensure that it is used to protect religious freedom and not abuse religious freedom.
Jack, you've been in that office now about 8 months. I'm just tickled to death to see that the joy you're having in doing the job and the good way in which you're doing it. What's happened over these 8 months that maybe has caused a ripple up the spine or caused you to go home and say, you know, I really am glad I'm doing what I'm doing?
So, Welton, you know, and listeners may remember that I spent a lot of years on the board of directors of Interfaith Alliance and even as chair of that board for a couple of years, and was always a willing participant in the course that you charted for the organization and was and remain one of your biggest boosters for what you've accomplished. But I don't think I understood from the inside what it really means to read the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Alexandria Gazette packet, and see what's going on in the world and knowing that we have a voice to weigh in on matters that affect the day-to-day lives of Americans, people of faith, people who don't profess a faith, people who interact with other people of faith. It really makes me feel like I am a part of history in the making when I know what we've been doing and what impact it's having on people who want to get married, people who want health care, people who just want the quiet enjoyment of their religious life.
Rabbi Jack Moline is Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance. His statement on the Act for America conference and political leaders taking part in it is up on our website, stateofbelief.com. Jack, as always, thanks for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton.
January 2016 will mark 10 years since the start of this program. In that time, I've had the chance to have countless fascinating and timely conversations with activists, politicians, newsmakers, and ordinary people from all across the country and even outside the country. And as that 10-year anniversary approaches, we'll occasionally dip into the archives for interviews that are worth hearing once again. This weekend, I wanted to look back at what we were talking about on Labor Day's past. It was the first weekend of September 2007, with a man named Barack Obama campaigning for the highest office in the land with a promise of universal health care. And on that occasion, I spoke to Mary Kay Henry of the Service Employees International Union. With the Affordable Care Act firmly in place and its repeal a popular talking point on the political right, it's worth remembering where things stood on Labor Day weekend 2007. Mary Kay Henry is a vice president with the Service Employees International Union. She's been a committed organizer for the past 25 years, and she credits her personal faith for prompting her engagement in union organizing. Mary Kay Henry, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you.
Mary Kay, we're told that more than 2 out of every 5 Americans are lacking job-based health insurance. I would think, most people would think, that with such a large percentage, people would be taking this fight to the street every day. Why are more people not taking an active role in trying to change this situation?
Well, I think one reason is that people are having to work longer hours just to make ends meet because of the pressure on American workers and families to try and provide the basic necessities for themselves and their children.
America, this is a whopping number that represents the increase in uninsured in the nation. Was this a one-year spike, or will the number of uninsured continue to increase?
Well, that's what we've been seeing, Reverend. Over the last 10 years, there's been a steady increase, and the projections kind of take us off the chart, which is why a lot of the members of SEIU and all the non-union workers that we are organizing are ready to have a national debate as part of the presidential campaign on why healthcare needs to be provided as a basic right in this country. And we intend to have a 24-month campaign that involves people all across America in making this demand on our government and on employers.
Well, I hope that's a way to stop the bleeding.
Yes.
Do you think that religious institutions are involved enough in this mission?
No. I don't think religious institutions are involved enough. I know that we've been working with many good people of faith, but I have to say, Reverend, I don't know if this is your experience, but there's a certain sense of hopelessness about how much individual congregations can affect a change. And that's why we think we need to be part of setting an interfaith table across this country that allows every person of faith to take action in the coming 24 months and feel some hope that if we elect the right people in Congress and in our state legislatures, that we can get our government to take action and hold business accountable for paying their fair share.
My outlook is that there is an incredible power to affect change in local houses of worship. But I want to be less institutional for a moment and more personal. You talk about the fact that you're in this organizing work because of your faith. Will you connect those two for our listeners?
Sure. I am a practicing Catholic, and I draw upon my basic belief that I think is a shared tradition across many different faiths of the goodness of people, and that church and labor in this country need to defend the dignity of all people. And I think that tradition that I draw upon makes me understand that we should have a right to expect a living wage, health care, decent education for every family to live in dignity. And yet we see people are losing their health care coverage. Americans are having to work longer to make ends meet. Wealth is getting more concentrated. And we think that's an economy that doesn't serve the people. And we think the labor movement has an incredible role to play in making sure that people have a way to participate in the full expression of their dignity. And being able to expand workers' ability to form unions and joining together church and labor to fight for basic rights like health care and education in this country are a key to making sure that those numbers don't keep spiraling upwards for the uninsured and that our wages don't keep dropping.
So very well said. Mary Kay Henry, International Executive Vice President of the SEIU, thanks for taking the time to be with us this Labor Day weekend here on State of Belief.
Thank you, Reverend.
That's an excerpt of a Labor Day interview first aired in 2007 with Mary Kay Henry, then a vice president with the Service Employees International Union. In 2010, she was elected international president of SEIU. We're revisiting a couple of memorable Labor Day interviews as we highlight past shows in preparation for our 10th anniversary next January. Labor Day 2009 came with an economy in severe turmoil, and that fall, unemployment levels for American workers were at their peak. In the midst of that reality, I spoke to Professor Bethany Morton, author of To Serve God and Walmart, The Making of Christian Free Enterprise. Here's part of that conversation. As Morton tells it, Walmart's approach to business has been based on two ideologies, free markets and Christian evangelicalism, a combination of which has produced the secret to Walmart's success in an area of the country that would have been most resistant to the rise of the chain store. Did Walmart set out to be an evangelical Christian company?
Definitely not. There are companies out there, Chick-fil-A, for example, companies that are very explicitly ministries, in a sense. And Walmart is not in that category. Part of what I found so interesting in this case was how much the sense of Walmart as a Christian institution was imposed from the bottom up and not really from the top down. And you ultimately then do have men in the top decision-making positions, many of them, who have sort of risen from the ranks and who also then bring up into the executive function many of these priorities. But the company publicly has walked a very fine line. On the one hand, they're well aware that their constituency is largely conservative Christians. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, they are an international corporation, and they've tried not to overtly assert that identity. It's just, it's not even really necessary.
As Walton watched these evangelical values kind of rise from the bottom up, how was that evident, if at all, in the structure of the company and how it was administrated?
Well, the most obvious case really is this kind of managerial philosophy of servant leadership, which is a phrase now that I think is pretty widely recognized. And it was fascinating to watch this idea, and the concept here is that not that we're going to have a business organization on the model of, say, a military organization, which used to be what they aspired to, right, where command mm-hmm. and structure and order and efficiency, but that rather the organization's going to run on service. Well, now this is a very logical development, right? We now are majority a service economy. Most of us work in service jobs. Most of us are evaluated at our jobs on the basis of how well we deal with other people, how well we serve. So to watch this philosophy move back and forth across the line from the evangelical revival, on the one hand, which animated servant leadership as the model for how people should run their homes, and at the same time, the people who were embracing that on the home front would get up and go to work and incorporate this idea into what are now increasingly their service workplaces. And for Walmart, which was the first service corporation to be the largest company on earth, you know, prior to that had been things like General Motors or Ford or Exxon, and suddenly here's Walmart, whose only mm-hmm. product really is service. Distribution is just serving customers. And suddenly that's the largest corporation on the planet. They needed a new model, and it was evangelical culture that offered it, and it's been extraordinarily successful for them, you know, up to the point where now we are going through checkout lines that aren't even staffed. So it's.
But isn't it ironic how a company that espoused family values in the form of service to others came ultimately to represent unbridled capitalism? So where do beliefs of evangelicalism and this belief in the free market intersect?
That's the question that, you know, that we come back to. How do you, when we talk about, well, there are these economic issues, and then there are these cultural distractions that, on the one hand, you have Milton Friedman-style free market economics that becomes our national orthodoxy after the 1970s, and on the other hand, you have these, what are portrayed as these somewhat silly distractions like anti-homosexuality and anti-abortion politics. And the normal story of the culture wars is that somehow these unbridled capitalists figured out to manipulate people who care about abortion and homosexuality as their top issues, that the financiers and the capitalists manipulated them into voting for administrations that would then turn around and enact this economic vision. And that struck me, again, as somewhat condescending. And so you have to ask, what might these two issues represent more broadly for people that would make this a more reasonable bargain between Jerry Falwell and Milton Friedman, right? Mm-hmm. Who are odd bedfellows, if you think about it. These mm-hmm. are not men you would really...
Yeah, they wouldn't want you to use that term.
Precisely. You have to remember, and this is where I think it really tells us something about the future, especially in this crisis moment that we're in right now, that it took an enormous amount of work to connect evangelical priorities, religious priorities, to this very narrow view of the world, that the market is the only final arbiter, that consumption is such an ultimate good. It takes a lot of work to maintain that connection, and I think an awful lot of religious people are in a position right now where they're rethinking that and returning to questioning why, for example, homosexuality and abortion have become so central to American religious experience, when in fact the New Testament has absolutely nothing to say about them, but it's full of statements about helping the poor, caring for your community, dealing fairly with people, showing compassion, and taking other people's material needs seriously. And I think right now, perhaps one of the healing strains that will come out of this crisis we're in is a broadening of religious viewpoints on what makes for a fair economic system.
From Labor Day weekend 2009, that's Professor Bethany Morton, author of the book To Serve God and Walmart, The Making of Christian Free Enterprise. Since that interview, by the way, Dr. Morton's book has won several prestigious awards. She continues to teach at Dartmouth University and has also become a founding faculty member of Freedom University, which offers college coursework without charge to qualified Georgia high school graduates regardless of immigration status. The tireless way President Jimmy Carter has continued to work for change in the world in the decades since leaving the White House has made him seem ageless. Articulate and active at age 90. When he made news, it was typically with an inclusive message on LGBT families culled from his reading of the Bible, or a call for peace somewhere in the world, or his latest book tour. So when the 39th President of the United States stepped to the microphone and calmly explained his cancer diagnosis last month, the news was shocking, even as his demeanor was characteristically calm. I'm grateful to be joined now by Rabbi Gordon Tucker, who served as a White House fellow during the Carter administration and saw firsthand the forces the president called upon during those troubled times. Rabbi Tucker, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Well, it's very good to be here, and I'm grateful for the invitation.
A lot of people were moved by the grace with which President Carter announced that his cancer had spread. Were you surprised at all by the serenity that President Carter showed that day?
Well, to an extent, I'm always a little surprised by any human being showing that kind of serene acceptance. It's not an easy thing to do, but knowing about his deep religious faith, it didn't seem in any way out of character.
Mm-hmm.
I think his faith, as is true of every person of deep faith, does promote that kind of acceptance and even serenity.
You know, I remember Jimmy Carter's Baptist faith as being an object that some people in Washington didn't understand when they first got to know him and were hearing about him through the press. But it was always striking to me that he relied on his faith when in the White House, but he didn't talk about his faith from the perspective of, I'm the President of the United States and this is my faith, and so on and so forth. Do you remember something about when people began to learn about his faith and how they handled it and how he handled it?
When he first ran for president, I had just finished rabbinical school, was a young instructor in Jewish philosophy at Jewish Theological Seminary. I wasn't involved in anything in Washington at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking at it as an American, as someone who was a registered Democrat. And I do remember that it was a little jarring to me to hear him talk about his personal faith, because it wasn't what we were used to hearing really, from politicians. And to the extent that we heard it, it was, as is even more intensely the case today, it was the kind of confession of faith that tended to spill over into one's political agenda.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there was a lot of apprehension about that, and I know that because I felt a little bit of it myself.
Sure.
But I think what was really quite unusual about his presidency was that you knew that that faith was there, but in strong contrast to some of the things we see today, it did not leak over into his political agenda.
Yeah.
There was never anything, for example, like what we're seeing now in Kentucky with a public official appealing to a higher authority about not following the law of the land in terms of registering same-sex marriages. I mean, these are the sorts of things that just didn't happen with Jimmy Carter. It happened that a few years later, I ended up having a Washington connection, becoming a White House fellow in his administration. And I did get to see a lot of things much more up close, and it kind of confirmed what I just have described to you.
Yeah, I agree. The explicit comments about the role of religion in his life and presidency, that just wasn't something that came from him. But did you see unspoken expressions of his religion when you were in the White House?
So I should clarify that although the program is called the White House Fellows Program, I was at the Carter Justice Department, and I was not in the White House day to day. I was not, I didn't have direct contact with him, but I was part of the administration. I was on the staff of the U.S. Attorney General, and I was involved with all sorts of directives and initiatives and agenda items that originated in the White House and that that came to the department. I was there in 79-80.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened that year could make your head spin.
Mm.
At the very beginning, there was that famous speech on about energy, and the speech that became known as the Malaise speech was at the very beginning of my year there. During that year, the Shah was admitted to the United States, and then the hostages were taken in Iran. There was a failed rescue the following April. The Soviets invaded Afghanistan, and there was a grain embargo that was imposed on the Soviets. There was a boycott of the Moscow Olympics. There was a decision to argue a case of a Nazi war criminal in front of the Supreme Court. There were all sorts of really unusual events that took place all in a single year, and he was president, of course, for 4 years. I'm raising all of this because I guess to some extent you have to have a certain kind of serenity to be able to weather all of those things, but more important is that everything that we saw coming from the White House on these matters showed a kind of concern for the rule of law, to make sure that all the things that were being contemplated as policy initiatives were run by the legal experts among whom I was working, to make sure that the I's were dotted and the T's were crossed, and that things were done in a respected and respectable way.
Yeah.
I attributed that in part to a sense of rectitude that came from his faith as well.
And it seemed to me that he understood the institutional relationship between church and state in a way that many of the people who have sat in that office since then did not understand.
I believe that's right. And it's kind of ironic because, in a way, he was perhaps, you know, personally speaking, the most devout of all of them. And during the campaign, the lead-up to his presidency, he did talk about that faith enough to make a few people uneasy, more than a few. And yet, it turned out that there was a real respect for that line between church and state. Absolutely.
I want to ask you specifically about his relationship with the Jewish community. We all remember that President Carter faced some real opposition regarding his policies toward Israel. Do you remember that being discussed, or was it strictly a matter of philosophical differences? How did all of that come about?
Well, look, it was a few months before I got to the Justice Department. was that phenomenal achievement of the peace treaty between Israel and Egypt. That happened on his watch. I mean, it is one of the things that has been and continues to be a great asset to Israel and its security, even weathering, you know, so many of the upheavals in Egypt over the last couple of years. So, you know, the idea that there was some inevitable tension between Carter and Israel, Carter and the Jewish community, just really doesn't hold up. There were tensions, of course, and even more so after his presidency. As we all know, it came to a kind of a peak, I guess, with the publication of his book, Palestine Peace, Not Apartheid. And I want to say about this that I think that some of Carter's understandings of Israel, of what Israel is, should be, could be, have not been helpful to Israel, but I do not attribute it in any way to any kind of hostility towards Israel, or certainly not the Jewish community. Let's remember, Stu Eisenstadt was his domestic policy advisor. He just wrote a very admiringly of him the other day in the New York Times. I attribute it precisely to his deep faith. And one of the interesting things that came out in that controversial book I've mentioned is the ways in which he was really not able to relate to the secular aspect of Zionism. Mm-hmm. He nonplussed Golda Meir by asking her whether it bothered her that so many people in her country, you know, seemed to lack faith and were irreligious, and she just didn't even know what he was talking about. Mm-hmm. They were coming from two different places, and I think that Jimmy Carter had an understanding of Israel that was very biblically based and was marked by an image of Israel that was supposed to be fulfilling all of the ideals of biblical religion in the modern world, when in fact Zionism was about dealing with the rough and tumble of the modern world and the kinds of things that had buffeted Jews and more than buffeted them, I'm using very mild language, to create a home, a haven, a place where democracy could thrive against the odds, and all of those things become very, very messy, not the neat idealistic things that we may think about when we talk about a peaceable kingdom. Mm-hmm. I think that what we have seen in Carter's, particularly his post-presidential career, is the Jewish community and the Israeli community and Jimmy Carter really talking past each other on skewed lines.
Is there anything else about what you saw related to his faith and the way he functioned in the Oval Office that we ought to mention?
Carter became president, it was only a couple of years after the Watergate scandal, and we had had what turned out to be a kind of a bridge or an interim presidency under President Ford. You may remember that at Carter's inauguration, he turned around and warmly thanked President Ford for his role in healing the country. I think Carter did set out and did accomplish in many ways a cleansing of that in the halls of government, and there was that insistence on the rule of law being followed, and making sure that policies could be defended, and were not being concocted in a nefarious way without transparency. These were things that I think came from a sense of rectitude and ethics that was part of his culture and his faith.
And, you know, he was very much a part of his culture. He was deeply committed to the work of the Southern Baptist Convention as it was at that time in history before the major changes in it. I always wondered, because I knew those points about him well, but I wondered how much of who he was in his culture and in that convention and how that related to the broader world, whether it was not just about a Baptist statesperson, but was he also in tune with a more universal, deeply lived out spirituality?
Well, his emphasis during his administration on human rights being an important American agenda item, an important American initiative throughout the world wherever possible, I think was clearly emblematic of that sense of universal ethics. And without a doubt, this has been remarked on so many times, his post-presidential career is, I don't know if you can think of a more impressive one in terms of what he has done, how he has stayed involved in world affairs, not primarily for any self-aggrandizement, but truly for helping promote the values that he holds. They may not be everyone's values. People may disagree with him on different policies, but they cannot gainsay the fact that he has not only talked the talk, but walked the walk as far as his commitments were concerned after his presidency. Maybe President Taft, who spent years on the Supreme Court after his presidency, can be a close second to the kinds of really important and constructive things that were done after the presidency. But Carter really has set a high bar for that.
Rabbi Gordon Tucker is Senior Rabbi of Temple Israel Center in White Plains, New York. Rabbi Tucker served as a White House fellow in 1979 during the Carter administration. Rabbi Tucker, I really do appreciate you being with us today and sharing your thoughts about faith and former President Jimmy Carter, as we all wish him strength and healing in the days ahead. Thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
It's been a pleasure, and thank you so much for the warm welcome and for the opportunity to talk.
It's time for another edition of the Intersection Awards, where we risk life and limb at the intersection of religion, government, and politics to flash a green, yellow, or red light at some of the latest near misses and collisions at this always busy and always dangerous crossroads. My producer, Ray Kirstein, has some headlines for us to ponder. Ray?
Thanks, Welton. So first, Kentucky County Clerk Kim Davis has become a hero of the anti-gay right for refusing to issue marriage licenses to same-gender couples based on her deeply held religious convictions. She's now being deeply held in jail. My nominee for the Intersection Award, however, is Senator Lindsey Graham, for not falling into the trap of Mike Huckabee and others who are hailing Davis as some kind of religious liberty hero and instead saying the following.
As a public official, comply with the law or resign. I appreciate her conviction, but she's accepted a job where she has to apply the law to everyone, and that's her choice.
Big, big green light. What a wonderfully insightful and courageous statement for Lindsey Graham to make, even though it ought to be just the way things are. I am really pleased always when leaders in our government defend the Constitution in a manner that makes us believe religion still has protection, as does government from religion has protection, and that we can eventually get it all right about how those two entities ought to relate to each other. So I'm pleased to see what Lindsey Graham did, what also presidential candidates Fiorina and Kasich did. This is very encouraging.
Okay, here's the second one. As the refugee crisis continues to create tragic headlines in Europe and elsewhere, the government of Iceland was offering to shelter 50 of the victims of war and violence. Then a prominent Icelandic author took to social media to call for a greater response. And that quickly led to 11,000 Icelanders, at last count, publicly offering shelter and assistance. That's 11,000 people out of the country's total population of only 300,000. It's rather remarkable that in our nation, despite so much religious rhetoric in our politics, there really hasn't been a comparable call for Americans to individually step up and help in this kind of crisis.
Well, you're exactly right, and what happened in Iceland deserves another big green light. You know, Ray, I may be wrong about this, but I've been thinking about it a lot. Left to our own values, most people seeing such hurt and such danger would be for helping people in that situation. I think we have good hearts at base. What often prevents us from showing that compassion is the division that has been created politically and has prostituted religion terribly. If we would allow each entity to share its own discipline and values, we'd be so much better off. It's so much easier, so much more gratifying to give a green light to these people helping other people in a desperate situation than it is to point out people running for the presidency and trying to advance their political careers using religion not to be the basis of that kind of compassion, but to be used to advance their own ambitions.
And the last one, the notorious Alliance Defending Freedom, a giant nonprofit legal outfit that seems to inject itself into every mean-spirited culture war battle these days and always presents itself as standing in defense of religious liberty, played a leading role in firing up opposition when a Missouri high school permitted a transgender student to use the girls' bathroom and locker room. The school district had issued a clear statement supporting acceptance of all students, regardless of gender or sexual orientation. Shockingly, after parents consulted with ADF, 100 students staged a walkout in protest of their transgender classmate being treated with respect and dignity.
Well, okay, there goes a straight order of green lights. Alliance Defending Freedom needs a big red light. Stopping them would be our hope, and also encouraging others to stop that kind of behavior wherever they are. You know, we talk so much in this nation about quality education. Quality education involves expanding people's understanding of the importance of diversity, even the value of diversity. And here is a group being where it ought not be in the midst of administering a school, trying to get students to be more narrow, more prejudiced, more unreligious. That always deserves a red light because they're trying to take away quality education as well as the freedom that is to characterize our nation. Red, red, red. Well, that's it for this week's Intersection Awards. Overall, I'd say traffic is moving a little more smoothly than usual, but perhaps that's only because it's a holiday weekend. We'll check the situation again in the near future. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to thank you sincerely and encourage you to continue your generosity. The ongoing financial support of our listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. If you find value in what you're hearing, and if you think it's important that more people hear what you're hearing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast and find links mentioned during the show. Follow us, please, on Facebook and Twitter. Share the stories you find compelling with your friends. We would love for them to be involved in the conversation. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Getty. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. Could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was.